Hello, my name is Alina Merritt, and we're here in Souk on November 10th, 2007. And right now we'll be doing an oral history interview, and I'll be interviewing Dave Huber about his peacekeeping mission in Iran and Iraq. And if you'd like to introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Okay. My name is Dave Huber. I served with Canadian Armed Forces regular service from 1983 till 2004. I was employed in the capacity of a medical assistant the entire time of my career. The PSO, or peace support operation, that we're talking about today will be the UNIMOG one, the United Nations Iran-Iraq Military Observer Group, which took place in 1988. It was UN Resolution 619 and known as Operation Vagabond.
Great. So as a researcher, I'm trying to understand the attitudes that were that you had as a peacekeeper, as well as the people around you. I think an oral history interview is a great way to do that. So that's one of my intentions, as well as how it was like to come back to Canada after your mission. And I'd like to ask you some questions today about your service, and is this okay with you?
Certainly.
Okay, great. So we'll start with, do you have any family background with military or peacekeeping? Were any family members in the military?
My grandfather on my mother's side was a private with the... I think it was the Sea Scots. Sea Scot R, Canadian Scottish Regiment. He went to, he was in the Second World War. He was deployed to Northwest Europe. He got into France 6 weeks after D-Day, was with Canadian troops all the way through Holland into Northern Germany, into the Scheldt Estuary area. And that finished out his wartime career. So yeah, I was familiar with the fact that my grandfather had served. But I believe he's the only one that they like to talk about. There is linkages to family history on the other side of the border, but there's not a lot of advertising about that from the Austrian side of the house. But
okay.
My grandfather's who I relate with.
Did that influence your involvement?
Tertiarily, yes. I just have to say, for some reason, there is always a sense of respect for his service. I wouldn't say it was like a reverent thing, but it was something that you paid courtesy to. It wasn't anything that he'd advertise a lot. He was very close-mouthed about a lot of instances until I came back from Iran, and then we were on the same footing. He would talk a little bit more about a few different things, but yeah, he did have influence.
He talked about things with you because you both experienced what it was like in conflict. So you told me earlier that you joined the military service quite early.
Yeah.
Right out of high school.
Right out of high school.
So how did your family react when you joined the service?
Actually, it was probably an ongoing evolution. My grandfather had influenced me, like I said before, with his military service, and I thought that was kind of neat. So I ended up being introduced to Army cadets. So I went into the Army cadets for a few years. And that evolved into doing some time with the primary reserve. So I was with the infantry in the reserve. And then from there I evolved right over into the regular force upon graduation from high school. And I was accepted into the medical services. So I became a medic.
Okay. And did your parents, what did they think?
They thought it was pretty good. They could see the natural progression. They liked the idea because of what the cadets and reserves was teaching, you know, citizenship and whatnot. They didn't have to worry about me ever getting into trouble. They knew where I was at all good at all times, and was gainfully employed, and they supported it.
Okay.
Yeah, they thought it was pretty cool.
So it was a pretty positive reaction.
It was a very positive reaction, yeah.
Okay. All right, so moving now to your experience overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind explaining what it was first like when you arrived?
Okay.
when you got off.
Right when we actually landed?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you want us to stop the tape here just for a second?
All right, and we're back. So, what was the overseas situation like when you first arrived?
Okay, when we got off the plane, what was the situation on the ground? It was very confused to begin with. They were just starting to get grips as to how this operation was going to happen because it was a no notice to move sort of organization. There was very little workup time, so we got on the ground. We had to move vehicles to a compound. There was still lots of settling. Shall we say settling maneuvers and actions being taken by the combatants. There was still gunfire in the town that we were in. There was the moving of tanks and personnel were still being moved, even though under the UN mandate they're not supposed to move anything. There's still lots of moves going on. It was pretty scary. The first two nights on the ground, first 2 days on the ground, we were kept to a compound. We were just getting our stuff shuttled in, so it was very, I guess you would say, fluid.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about your daily routine? What it was like?
Well,
each day?
Let's see here, because it covers a few months, and because of the mandate, we moved around the country. We flew into a place called Bakhtaran, which is in central western Iran. That was where our western headquarters was. We had detachments all along the border. We had guys up in Sequez, which is north western Iran, and up around the Kurdistan, up around the Kurdish-held territories, and Tabriz was the biggest city up north in Iran. We had troops in Dezful, which used to be an American Air Force base when the Americans were there, and the Iranians used it as their major Western Air Force base. And further on down south, which was where I was stationed, was a place called Awaz, which is on the southern end of Iran on the western desert, right on the Tigris-Euphrates River, just outside of it, probably not even 20 kilometers. Next to an Iranian town called Abadan. Mm-hmm. Our daily routine, once we got everybody situated where they were supposed to, consisted of providing medical support for detachments which went out from these little areas. Now, I was in Awaz. We had six detachments that were communication detachments for relays to provide communications for the military observers who were doing patrols throughout the area. Our job, or my job, was to provide medical support, first line medical aid for all the Canadian contingents that were in those communication relays, which were all armed forces signalers. So we'd have to go out to the debts. We'd go out to a different debt almost every day or every other day. We'd be on the road making sure that they knew about the scorpions, how to take care of bites and stuff like that. Do sick parade. Is there anybody with any problems with the food or anything like that? And that did become a concern. Actually.
The food?
Oh, yeah. We were on hard rations the entire time we were there.
Wow.
Which is boil in the foil rations. So the real threat or the real concern there was vitamin deficiency after a couple of months.
What about climate as well? Because coming from Canada, right, going into Iran, quite different climate. So
in August, September, and October, the average temperature on the Humidex was 55 degrees Celsius. We were doing vehicle patrols almost every day to service your vehicle. To get into your vehicle, you had to have gloves on. You couldn't handle anything on the vehicle with bare hands. You'd burn yourself. Metal was that hot. 55 degrees Celsius days also meant that you had to consume a lot of water, and it was 12 liters per man per day. So one case of water was what was required for each service member for each day. Times 400. Times, what were there, 4 months? That's a lot of water. More water than fuel. We ended up using more water than fuel. That and the fact that you had to get around some of the local customs. And Iran being a fundamentalist Shia community, it is forbidden to take your shirts off or roll up your sleeves. So our sleeves had to be rolled down. We were buttoned up the entire time. So you couldn't even take your shirt off to do heavy manual labor to sling all those supplies that we had to move back and forth. And I'd say about 60% of our time we were slinging supplies, you know, just to service ourselves in the austere conditions that we were in. So the day was a lot of time on the road, a lot of time slinging supplies, seeing the odd sick parade. Didn't see a whole lot of medical problems, thank goodness. But it was a lot of work. It was a lot of hard work. And then on top of that, you had to get around the fact that you're in a winding down war zone. The Iranians didn't exactly welcome us with open arms when we got there. In 1988, the Iranians had pushed back the Iraqis to the original border and were actually taking ground in Iraq. And then and only then did Saddam Hussein decide he wanted to sue through peace through the United Nations because he was losing. So the Iranians were winning the war, and then all of a sudden they're thrust to the UN peacekeeping table. Then all of a sudden they're not that happy to see us because they were winning. So we weren't welcomed with open arms. We went nowhere without escort. We were actually told that we couldn't go into certain areas until they were, until the proper authority was given, which means until they moved something, hid something, stopped doing something.
They were raining.
Yeah. Okay. We drew fire, I don't know how many times, to the point where I wouldn't wear my frag vest. Me and my friend, there's only three medics in our area. Me, another corporal, Franco, and a sergeant. The sergeant, being a sergeant, didn't go out in any of the patrols, so me and the corporal did. And it got to the point there when I got pictures of bullet holes in our vehicles. We wouldn't wear our frag vests. We'd actually put them down on our door sides. And I got a couple of pictures of some nice bullet holes going through just in front of the doors. So, no, they didn't welcome us very much.
Wow. Yeah.
They didn't want us there.
We're going to be talking about that later with a few questions about the... you know, the prejudices that were there and the that you saw locally and both within your... Maybe we can...
There's some cultural things there that were actually quite severe as far as a shock. Did you want to talk about those now?
Sure.
Or okay.
Go ahead.
A quick brief... Okay, what we were told before we got into Iran, I told you we were given very little notice to move on this operation. It was to the point that we were leaving CFP Petawawa. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. We had been issued our weapons. We had turned in our kit. We were on a 40-passenger tour bus. We were just physically getting ready to leave the main gate when the bus was stopped. An intelligence officer got on. A couple of MPU senior NCOs got on. They handed out a whole bunch of books to us. And in these little pamphlets, I'll have to secure one for you. Talk a little. It was printed out really quickly and it was very fastly produced. It was a last-minute thing. Vehicle identification pictures, you know, to identify what kind of vehicles they are, because the Iranians had primarily American equipment and the Iraqis had primarily Soviet. So if you saw something, you could kind of figure out which side of the border you were on. But it also had cultural issues in there. Being fundamentalist Shia province or community, things that were taken into account, things that you could do, things you couldn't do. Things you must do and things you must not ever do.
What would some of those things be?
Do not stare at women. Do not look at women. Leering was not tolerated. Whipping. You get a public whipping for that. Sleeves had to be rolled down the whole time. Buttoned up collars. No playing of music of any kind in public because it was considered lewd. The thing I got a kick out of was no public gaming.
What What does that mean, gaming?
No public gaming. Persia is where the game of chess was invented, but you could not play it in public.
So no games.
No games. It was considered scheming, and scheming was against the Quran. So yeah, there's talk about adultery and the stonings and the hanging and the taking off of hands for thievery. They're telling us stuff like this.
What was your initial reaction to all these things that you're seeing?
We were in information overload. It was a big culture shock, and like I said, there was no workup time for this. The Airborne Regiment Battle Group was the last battle group in the Canadian Armed Forces to get the new weapons. And what I mean by new weapons is everybody in the Armed Forces today has a C7 rifle, which is like an American M16. In 1988, the Airborne Regiment, we were still using the submachine guns and the Fabrique Nationale C1A1. Because of this tour, in 2 days, we were given 2 months of weapons training so that we could go into an operational theater with a new weapon, to which we didn't really know a lot of. And because it was such a new weapon, there was problems with it. Which, being in the airborne, you know, you want to be comparable to your own security. And one of the problems was it had plastic magazines. Plastic magazines don't do well when it's 55 degrees out. They tend to melt. So it was little hiccups like that caused some concern.
Okay, well, this is good to know to give background, I think.
Okay, so getting off topic.
No, it's fine. When you were going into Iran, how did the army? You said they only gave you for like 2 days training for that one weapon.
Yes.
Did they adequately train you for the
mission? Oh, for the context of the mission?
Yeah.
There was no time for it. There was no time for mission specific training. There was, how can I put this in context? Back in 1988, there was no formalized peacekeeping support operation training that there is today. There was none. It was on-the-job training, 9 times out of 10. But the other concern that was brought this mission, apart from the other ones that we'd had at the time, is up until then, the majority of the Canadian peace support operation experience was the Golan Heights and Cyprus. This tour was a little bit different from those two tours in the fact that it was a Roto Zero and we were going in between two combatants that did not want to have peace. Was there any training on it? They were scrambling. Ottawa was scrambling. External Affairs Canada was scrambling like you could not believe, because there was no knowing. For some reason, the world had turned its face on Iran and Iraq. You know, there wasn't a whole lot known about that war, that conflict, other than what they knew about Iran from the Khomeini days of the American hostages. That was what the world perception of Iran was, and I'll have to tell you, that's all mine was. I found out that we were going to Iran. It scared the hell out of me, to be absolutely honest.
Why was that?
Because it was something that, out of all my training, we never trained for. We never trained for desert operations. I had never trained for peace support operations. All of my military and medical training was for wartime stuff, for offensive operations.
So you didn't feel
adequately trained? Mm-hmm. Not really. We were on a defensive posture. You were on a defensive posture when you were on the ground. For lack of a better word, always looking over your shoulder. I remember before we were actually moving down south from Bactran, the very first patrol to get all our stuff in situation, we actually had orders groups, and we actually went through the drills for a vehicle ambush because we didn't know whether or not we were going to draw fire on it, and we had to go through all the vehicle ambush drills. You know, who was going to do what, where, when. What, all the way down to radio frequencies and how do we get out of here. I think we spent more time doing that than we did workups for the thing in Canada because there was no time. When we were loading the trucks on the planes, on the American planes, actually, we had to get the American Starlifters, the Globemasters, to fly us out, or Galaxies, I should say. we had to rip the paper off of the windshields because they had just painted our trucks white. They were just freshly painted. It was a last minute thing. Just, I remember taking off all the paper off of all these freshly painted trucks.
So you felt quite rushed.
It was. It was very rushed.
Do you think that sacrificed the mission itself?
I'd say yes and no. I say no in the fact that all the mission critical equipment got on the ground, all the CRATS vans, which were all the encrypted communications equipment, they got on the ground no problem. They did have a lot of problems with that equipment due to the harsh temperatures. They had a lot of problems with our vehicles because of the harsh temperatures. My ambulance got the last GMC fuel filter in Western Iran, because we kept losing the fuel filters because of all the sand, the fine dusts, and tell the guys to start getting all their wives and girlfriends to mail us pantyhose. We used to wrap those around them on the air filter so that they wouldn't get choked up with sand. Little things like that. So no, it didn't affect the mission in the fact that everything that was needed to do the mission got on the ground. How did it affect the mission? A lot of scared people that weren't that confident in what our role was. Again, it's the mindset. I was a member of the Canadian Airborne Regiment, and we were on a war footing as far as all our training was war fighting. And then to be told to take the magazine off my weapon because it was offensive looking and we didn't want to intimidate anybody, I found quite offensive, considering the fact that everybody was pretty shit scared on the ground.
So emotionally, like mentally?
We weren't prepared.
No.
No.
Okay. Did the training change? Did you receive any more training? No.
We had two days on the weapons. We had one day in the gas hut. Would have liked a lot more on the gas. No vehicle training. We had to amalgamate 1, 2, 3, 4 units had to come together with no notice to move and had to work cohesively in a theater of operations, and we had about 2 weeks to do it. So they took 400 people from 4 different units and said, you have to work together and we're sending you to a war zone to do it. So it was a little overwhelming, shall we say.
Was there frustration with the...
Frustration at all levels. Mm-hmm. At higher, at middle management, and at our end. I consider our end the lower end or the pointy end of it.
So, learning all of this that, that you weren't that adequately prepared, mm-hmm. or mentally, or...
We weren't physically, operation. Mentally,
yeah.
The equipment scales were all lacking.
So how did you perceive the mandate then? How did you see?
They kept telling us the mandate because that's the one thing everybody knew. They knew what the mandate was. The mandate was to enforce a ceasefire line. Our job, or the job of the signalers, was to provide communications the whole length of that border, 1,100-mile border. They were to provide communications uninterrupted, 24/7, to the military observers. Now, we were a Canadian static force of all these little detachments, of all these little communication towers. And then they had another group, which were all the military observers, and they were coming from Pakistan, India, New Zealand, Australia, England, Ireland, United States, France, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Kenya, Tanzania, Argentina. We had them from all over. And their job was to go out and do the patrols, and they would take some Canadian bodyguards, for lack of a better word, and support personnel, and we would be part of that. The animals would go out and want to see a forward location. Well, chances were there was a Canadian debt there, so me and my buddy would get in our ambulance and go out and go check the troops. We'd see these frontline positions with these observers, and if they had a concern as to, has anybody moved? Have the Iranian or the Iraqis moved forward? You know, they would talk across border to the observers that were on the Iraqi side of the border to find out who's moving where. Because there was conflict from the day we got there to the day we left. In our sector alone, which is from Awas to the Gulf, 200-mile frontage, there was an average of 4 fatalities a day. There was sniping, there was cross-border or cross-battle line patrolling. There was a lot of mortar incidents. There's a lot of that going on from the day we got there to the day we left.
Were you prepared for that type of conflict, 4 fatalities a day?
No, because it was an untrained for thing. I had about the same idea of what peacekeeping was as probably you do. It's what the media told us. Because I said, in the unit I was in, we never did one peacekeeping exercise. So I always thought, from what I heard on the news, is Canadian troops go in, they put on a blue beret, they stand there with the rifles, and everybody separates, and everything is good. You know, they go up and down just to make sure everybody's away. And that was my idea of what it was. Yeah, what actually happens on the ground? Things are fluid. Things happen.
So, as you say, as being a soldier, you have to be your role now in Iran is a peacekeeper, which is, would you say, different? You know, that
again, it's a dichotomy of the two. It's
because
a two-headed
you are a
coin.
Soldier, yeah.
It took us, honestly, it took us about 3 weeks to get sorted out to where we felt comfortable in our own boots, for lack of a better word. We understood which guys that were escorting us from the Iranian army we could rely on and which guys we couldn't. Once we found out what the routine was, where everybody was on both sides of the border, what the context was of the mission on the ground as to what was on paper, which are usually two different things. Once we came to grips with that, everybody settled down quite a bit. Once you weren't scared that things were going to blow up in your face, because there was a lot of concern about that for those first few weeks. Number one, because we didn't know better. Number two, was because I don't think the situation knew yet. There was just too much moving of units and moving of lines and stuff going across the border.
Mm-hmm.
It took a while to settle down.
Okay.
To come to grips with the peacekeeping part of it. Once we found out that nobody was going to blow us out of our boots, we were a little happy to just go along and toe the party line, so to speak. Try not to get any on us.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that you had enough mandate, like enough...
resources?
Well, enough power through the protocol that you were given to effectively keep the peace and complete your mission?
I can't speak for my part of the thing. Did I have enough mandate to do what I needed to do as a medic,
mm-hmm.
to take care of my troops? We were never denied access to a Canadian position. We were denied access when we wanted to, because, let's say, on a Tuesday we wanted to go check our lines. The Iranians would stop us and go, no, you can't go through today. Well, why? Because I have to get authority, and we've been there like 4 times before. You know, what's the big deal? And then the 5th time we go through, we notice where that artillery unit that was there go. And then we go see our troops and stuff. So they were still making moves. Did they stop us from providing medical care? No. Did they delay us and interrupt us at any given opportunity? Yeah, because it would depend on what they wanted to do. I know the military observers themselves were unbelievably frustrated at times, because of all the fatalities that were going on that shouldn't have been going on because of the mandate.
Did you have close
ties? Oh, yes.
Interaction with them?
Yeah.
So you got to know what they were feeling as well?
Oh, they would just bleed at the shoulders too every once in a while. Body exchanges were rough. The POW exchanges were atrocious. And that was their partnership, where they do both of those. And they had a lot of problems doing both those. They were just interrupted all the time. So those ones didn't go over that well.
Okay. So did you feel that the peacekeeping, your mission, received enough support from, first, the Canadian government, second, the United Nations, and third, the Canadian public? Let's start with the government. Did you feel that it received enough support? Either politically or financially?
I don't think the government had a lot of say in it after they said go, as to whether or not we could get any more support from them back in 1988. Because as soon as we were cut loose, as soon as the way a peacekeeping mission goes is the United Nations asks governments for troops, and the governments go, yes, here's 1,500. There you go. That's the last say Canada has in those troops until they want them back. Once they say that, those troops become UN, and UN pays you and feeds you and decides how many vehicles you can have to go do your thing and how many rifles you can have to do your thing and how many bullets you can have. Your government doesn't say that, and your military doesn't say that. The UN decides how much you're going to get for all that. Did we get support from our government?
Politically, maybe.
I never saw a politician.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I shouldn't say that. I saw Mr. Beattie when we got back to Montreal. Never saw. I don't think they knew we were gone.
Well, then how about the United Nations? You spoke on that. Did you feel that they...
And I know this from the UNMOS. Their hands were tied the entire time. They had troubles with just about anything. You know, if they went to the UN going, listen, okay, we've got a CIR to report, significant incident to report, usually fatality or whatnot, then they'd have to get somebody out of bed or they'd have to interrupt somebody at a cocktail party or something like that, because there is no dedicated 24/7 UN operational staffing officer in New York to take care of stuff like that. So there's a lot of frustration at that level. Did we get a lot of support from the UN? On the pointy end of it, I would say no. Medically, there's a lot more equipment that me and our guys in our debt would like to have had, but we were restricted to the tables that the UN said we could take. We only had one road ambulance to cover 200 miles 24/7, and there was two of us to do that. So were we supported by the UN to do that? I don't think so. Luckily, any of the mining accidents that they had were all Iranian or Iranian civilian. The vehicle accidents that we witnessed, we were not allowed to stop that.
How did that feel?
Actually, you know, you feel bad because I remember we saw one accident happening, and we were just cringing because they driving in the Middle East is not like driving in North America. It's very offensive driving. They drive around in these big Mercedes buses, and it's a 40-passenger bus, and there'll be 80 people in it. And they'll drive 120 kilometers an hour down the road, and there's no rules to the road. And to see one of those flip, and you know there's people getting hurt all over the place, but you know, too, that we didn't have the resources to help anybody, to be absolutely honest. Mm-hmm. We'd have been overwhelmed. That and the perception of infidels touching the skin of someone from the Middle East is not looked upon very well.
That must have been a very hard dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
To see people hurt. I'd assume that your initial feeling would be to help them.
To drop, yeah.
But then you can't. Yeah.
It's a cultural thing there. It was bad.
Well, how about the Canadian public? You talked about how there were very little politicians. What about the public? Do you think that they knew a lot at the time about...
My mom said that she saw a CTV news item about Canadian troops going over. My mom and dad knew I was over. My mom and dad's friends knew I was over. Well, that was about it.
So very little.
I don't think it was on the radio. I don't think it was in the newspapers.
How did that affect the morale of the troops? Knowing that there was a lack of knowledge about what you were doing.
That was the norm for the time. Canadian public had very little news as to what was going on in the CF, and I don't really think they really cared at that point in time. As long as we looked good. You know, as long as we were peacekeeping, in their eyes, everything was going great. But Canadian public has no idea what peacekeeping is. You know, I'd like to ask 10 of them, what's your definition of a peacekeeper? And I bet you they couldn't come up with one. They think it's somebody who wears a blue beret, holds a rifle, looks good, and doesn't hurt nobody.
Don't get a lot of work done. What would you like to say to those people?
Here's your blue beret, here's your rifle, here's a good reference, stand there. No, you can't. It's hard to say how you would describe it to somebody. It's not my place.
Okay. Well, we talked before about, we mentioned about some of the obstacles that were surrounding the mission's successful completion of the mission, or maybe even whether or not it was successful as...
The successful accomplishment of the mission. According to United Nations, the protocol of 619 was to implement a ceasefire. In 1988, they had their ceasefire. By the time that we left, they had their Motorola communication system for the animals, which stayed behind because they had a one-year tasking out there to do that. But then all of a sudden, then the Gulf War broke out in 1990. And it's kind of funny how enemies can become bad mates very quickly. I had mentioned about the air base in Desville. During the Gulf War of 1990, all of a sudden the Iraqis and the Iranians are good friends. And the Iraqis scrambled all of their mid-jets, the nice shiny ones that they got from the Russians, over to Desville. These are two nations that have been warring since 1980. Documented well over a million casualties. So it's a strange...
So whether it
was the mission successful or not?
Hard to answer.
They're fighting their friends. On paper, yes, because they stopped fighting above books. Reality, you have to talk to people that live in Abadan, that live in Awas, or in Bashar across the river.
Did you get a chance to see the reaction of the local people? And first that question, and then maybe you can touch on if you made relationships with any of the local people, or was that...
They clapped like you wouldn't believe when we came driving through. I remember driving through a lot of the smaller towns, and there's a lot of applause because... Every town that you drove through, and they were like little hamlets, just like you see in the movies, little mud huts in a lot of these places, with metal garage door fronts. And you could tell that you're coming up to a town because you would see nothing but a sea of black flags over the cemeteries. More black flags, the more cheering and applause there was as you drove through the town. It would probably be similar to what the Canadians had when they went through Holland.
In World War II.
Yeah, lots of cheering and applause when you went through those towns. Not so much when you got into the line. Once you got up to the line, they weren't happy to see you. But the population itself was very glad to see you. As far as making relations with individuals, we weren't allowed.
You weren't allowed to at all?
No. Oh no, the only interactions we had with anybody Iranian were our army guards or... the Islamic Revolutionary Guardsmen, which you'd asked me earlier about the culture, the country and stuff like that. It took me a while to figure it out. I do a bit of reading. You saw my library. I do a little bit of reading. What I would equate to make it really clear what Iran was like in 1988 would have been what Nazi Germany was in 1942 would probably be about the best assimilation I could probably give you. Propaganda everywhere. Painted on walls. Flags everywhere. Down to, in World War II, they had the Hitler Youth. in Iran, they have the Islamic Revolutionary Guardsmen, and they actually have a boys' militia where they dress up kids between the ages of 12, no, 11. 11 and 14 or something like that, because you can go into their armed forces at the age of 14. From 11 to 14 in their work warehouse green shirts and pants, and they march them around, and they got all the little badges and everything. It was like being in Nazi Germany in 1942. It was very much what it felt like. Propaganda and the culture, very anti-American, very anti-Soviet. We were not allowed to make relations, like I said, with any of the civilian population, just our guards. And we would have forced fun one night a week. Forced fun would be the Iranians want to play soccer, so get on the bus. We're taking you into Abadan. There's a soccer pitch there. You're going to play soccer at 9 o'clock in the evening. It got down to about 80 degrees Fahrenheit then. So we would play quote-unquote soccer. And then after that, the treat was is that we'd, right next to the soccer pitch, we'd go into a pool. Right on, a pool. Haven't seen a pool since we've been in country. Because all our washing was done by hand. There's another thing to that, too. We were taken to a pool as a civic pool. Olympic size. Had a change area. Got changed. Walked into the pool area. And we're absolutely appalled at all the cartoons. They had cartoon-like caricatures going all the way around this pool. And they were...
This was an indoor pool?
Outdoor pool. But it was all built up because it was like everything's open. If it was built up, it would be too hot to be in the building. So everything was open air. But it was all built up around it. But it was an Olympic-sized pool in a well-built-up sports complex. It's just that there's no roofs on any of these things. So it was all metal around it. So all these gate or fences or whatever. And
the
caricatures were just obscene. Cartoon drawn for kids, you know, to... of Uncle Sam being decapitated by a guillotine by the Ayatollah Khomeini, Black Bear being shot and being skinned by Ayatollah Khomeini, and these are cartoon characters in a public pool.
So this is a civilian pool?
This is a civilian pool. This is a civic pool.
For a community?
For a community. The very first Iranian hospital I saw was in Awaz. It was three stories high. And on one wall, it must have been 20 by 3 stories high, 20 feet by 3 stories high, was a great big wall mural. And it was a wall mural of the Statue of Liberty. Instead of holding a flame, was holding a bleeding skull, standing on not the ground or a pedestal, but standing on a mountain of bones and dying bodies.
That's on a hospital. How did you deal with that? Because you said before, you didn't know that much about the culture there.
Scared shitless. Like, if this is what the population sees every day, I'm putting a magazine on my rifle and I'm keeping it close to me and I'm staying away from these people. Spooky. Like I said, it was like Nazi Germany in 1942. Propaganda everywhere. Inappropriate. Right down to the children.
Did they believe it?
I couldn't tell you if the kids did or not. We never got close enough to see. There were a couple of propaganda pictures taken. I call them propaganda pictures. In our compound when we first got there. Of kids putting their hands through the fence just to touch somebody from outside of Iran. Just little kids being kids, you know, around a bunch of soldiers. But no, we didn't have a lot of interactions with the public. We did have, I mentioned that we were doing our clothes by hand, in Awaz. We took over an Italian oil company's yard, for lack of a better word, and we stayed in ACLO trailers there. And, we were allowed to have the Iranian cleaner, do our laundry for us. We couldn't talk to him. We weren't allowed to interact with him. The Iranian told us how we're going to give him his laundry and how we're going to get our laundry, and that was it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we couldn't pay him. He was going to be paid by the Iranians, which meant he wasn't going to be paid. So we'd have to sneak in, we'd sneak in American dollars in between our laundry and stuff like that, just to pay the guy, because he's an old guy. He had been through the ringer. You could tell he only had one eye. A couple of the guys said that they were talking to him. He'd lost a son. He'd lived in Ottawa his whole life. He was about the only guy that we ever knew anything about that was a civilian. He's a neat old guy. He's pretty harmless. Then we were told we weren't allowed to. We'd have to do our own laundry because they found out that the guys were like smuggling him money. So that was cut off. They said no more laundry. You have to do your own. So we do our own, which was a shame. That was the mindset. They were just not agreeable people.
So did you find it hard then to be neutral?
Very much so. We used to joke about actually. We used to joke about clearing minefields for the guys on the other side. The things you do. If they could do something to annoy us, they would. If they could turn off power to piss us off, they would turn off the power to our actual debt, the whole debt. Just inconveniencing things. Like I said, they would deny us. They wouldn't deny us access, but they'd deny us access that day to certain units. You know, anything to interfere. They'd almost go out of their way to do, just to be annoying. They were bored, or I don't know. They didn't change the rate of our pay the whole time we were there, but still. It got to the point, I used to smoke, and that became a real concern.
On your mission over there?
On my mission over there, because I had to bring all my cigarettes with me. Once you get into that country, there are cigarettes all over the place, but we weren't allowed to go out in public and buy them. And it was not a high priority through the Hercules resupply flights. They were trying to get 12 liters of water per day per man. Did they have room for cigarettes? No. Did they have room for anything else other than no? Bullets and water, and it was about all that came over, and lots of fuel. Believe it or not, we had to bring special fuel for some of the vehicles. It was 25 cents a tank of gas. The Iranians paid a penny. But anyway, I remember walking through a minefield with one of our Unmos to get some batteries, is what we called them, 25 set batteries. And that was a neat thing about the mission being communications, is that the Krat stands were encrypted, so the Iranians could tell what was being said across the borders. So we made a link up that we had to have the Iranians walk us through a minefield with these guys. It was me and two other guys, and all we were doing was schlepping. We were to get all these batteries from the guys on the Iraqi side, because they were short on 25 set batteries, which was a specific size battery for the backpacks that the Unmos had. And they said that there was a big shortage of them, so we had to get them from the other side. So we got all these batteries, got them back, and got back to our lines, put them in the supply hut, and then two at a time we go into the supply hut, and they take the batteries and cut them open, Rothman cigarettes. So walk through minefield to get cigarettes.
Wow.
Stuff you do.
That's quite an experience. Yeah.
So they interfered a lot.
So it was hard to remain neutral.
It was hard to remain neutral. Unbelievably hard to remain neutral.
But that was the main protocol. That was to remain neutral.
Yes.
Were you told that?
Were we told to remain neutral? No, because I don't think it didn't come
implied?
Into... Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was implied. We didn't have the means to do anything other than... it's not like we were conducting our own vehicle control points and seizing weapons. That wasn't our mandate. We didn't have the chance. We were just hoping nobody would take ours. So no, that wasn't really an issue.
Okay. So how did the role of your mission change over time? Did you find that you had to?
Not at all.
No,
not
it was
one
the
bit.
Same.
Yeah. Okay. Nothing changed. Mission-wise, no, the mandate never changed. Medically, nothing changed with the support that we were providing. Dun, 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 dun. Nope. And it wasn't that a lot really could, because once we got on the ground with all the stuff that we had, that was it. That was all that we had to work with, was what we had with us in our little depths. No, we were deploying first line medical care, trauma care, and that was it, and evacuation.
Okay. So how did you, you and your fellow colleagues, how did they cope with their missions? Were there long hours?
There were long days. Some of them were like 2 or 3 days. A lot of driving.
So how did you
cope with stuff that you saw?
Yeah, first let's deal with that.
You didn't. You didn't talk about it.
Didn't talk about
it. Nope.
There were no.
Or you joke about it. Remember the first time we got rounds in our vehicle. We didn't know about it until we stopped and we got out at, in Desville. Was it Desville? No, south of Desville. Around Coomershar, it's a big town. We stopped for a pee break or something like that, and a refuel stop. Yeah, it was a refuel stop. We had to go for fuel bottles. And one of the guys points, "Hey, Dave, look at that." And I looked in our truck, "Holy shit. Roman, somebody shot us." You know, we didn't even know about it. We were joking about it.
So you just laughed it off? You couldn't?
Can't do a lot more at that
yeah.
point. So we kind of laughed that one off. We weren't allowed to take pictures, but I did take some pictures. I should say we were allowed to take pictures. We were allowed to take pictures when they thought it was appropriate, which meant don't take pictures of anything unless you're told to take that you can take a picture. But a lot of the stuff you didn't talk about, because a lot of it was just gross. The Iranians don't clean their battlefields. So there wouldn't be a whole lot to talk about when you're driving through one. It's one time you roll up the windows.
Because of the smell?
Oh, yeah. 400, 500, 600 bodies. 50-degree temperature. A couple hundred dogs running wild. They've been running wild for 8 years in packs. That was the biggest threat. That was the biggest physical threat on the ground, were the dogs. 8 years of war, and you've got 8 years of pets roaming wild in there in packs.
Do you want to explain a little bit more about the dogs?
About the dogs?
Yeah.
Family dogs, or like farm dogs or whatnot, and you've had 8 years of war. They weren't being fed, they weren't being looked after. You know, people would take off and leave the little villages and leave the dogs.
So you've
got packs of dogs roaming around these fields. And they're wild, and the Iranians would shoot them on sight. You know, just break out a machine gun and mow them down, because they were a physical threat. They were a physical threat to even villages.
Would they kill people then?
Yes, they were rabid. They were wild animals at that point. That was the one thing we were told we could shoot, were the dogs. I never had an instance where I had to shoot a dog. I don't think I could shoot a dog, to be absolutely honest.
Did your group ever have problems with dogs?
Yeah.
They did?
Yeah. One of the SIG sergeants, I remember, had to go out and shoot a couple, but I wasn't around for that one.
Did you ever see that type of conflict before? Like, you're talking about, you know, you've seen like 600 people dead. Have you ever heard about that?
No. That was just gross. Ugh. No.
Did the military prepare you for that?
No, they didn't know what was going to be up here on the ground either, actually. As far as that goes, I think everybody was surprised at the fact that they didn't clean their own battlefields. Due to the fact that it's number one unsanitary, number two, just gross. I mean, it's dangerous too, because I remember driving down the road and seeing like these 155mm shells right on the shoulder of the road, and it's been fired, and you're driving by going, "Fuck, don't go off, fuck, don't go off."
Very tense atmosphere.
Oh yeah, I got a picture of my buddy Roman, he's just gritting his teeth because of the stink. We're driving by this one battlefield, I took a picture of him, because that's how we joke it off, eh? You get a puke, whoop, whoop. you know, make the sounds there to see if you get them to puke, you know, stuff like that. You had to break the tension where you could.
So a lot of joking and...
Mm-hmm. Black humor.
Black humor.
A lot of black humor.
Did you ever play, like, your group play games or do some sort of morale activities to release that tension? Was there time to? Or?
Actually, there was too much time. When you weren't on a patrol for like 2 or 3 days checking the lines and you came back and there wasn't, you didn't have a supply convoy come in with water and fuel or whatever, stores, to unload, then you literally had nothing to do and nowhere to do it. We couldn't even keep fit, me and Roma. We were both in your born regiment, and you couldn't run. Because running was a big part of the cardio fitness for us, and it was too hot. 2 o'clock in the morning, it'd be 80 degrees out. You know, we just could not physically do any PT, you know, because it was un-air-conditioned. It was just bleh. We were in a tiny compound that the Iranians guarded us, not anything else. They were guarding us.
Were those days quite hard, I would assume, or?
Were you quite bored?
Yeah.
Read a lot of used books from Sally Ann. They gave us boxes of these Bolin books and Bond books and Alistair MacLean books. And
so a lot of reading.
Read that. Played a little euchre. That was it. Because there wasn't a lot to do. Couldn't play games in public, couldn't play music.
Could you play music in your compound?
In our ADCOs we would. We just keep it turned down quite a bit.
I see.
Because of the guard saw, they get quite upset. No pornography. Because guys are always putting stuff up on the walls, you know, stuff like that. Not in that country. Don't get caught doing that. Do not get caught doing that. That was a big incident. One guy did get caught. And it was a big incident. Oof. But then again, there's not a lot of alcohol. Like, we weren't allowed alcohol either. Three big things which really shocked us when we found out we were going to Iran is that, number one, there will be no booze. Number two, there will be no women. Number three, there will be no Jews. They did not want women or Jews in their country.
Jews. Jewish people.
Jewish people.
And if that was you weren't, blatant.
That was, you should see the road signs.
Give me an example.
Right. Example of the road signs. It would be that cartoon-like road sign that you would see driving to the ferry, those great big long roadside ones, and it would be a picture of a Scud missile, or a frog is actually what was the Soviet ones that they had, was frog missiles, coming down, and it'd be a picture of a picture of the country with a great big Star of David with this rocket going down on it, you know, and then a lot of writing on it, and I remember asking one of our guards, the thing, well, what's that say? Well, it's the eventual destruction of the State of Israel.
And these were government issued because they were road signs. Right? Yeah. This wasn't.
This was not a kid with a spray can. Publicly funded. Big time. They hate everybody.
So coming from Canada, going into such a
prejudiced society, found it quite offensive.
So how did you, today, how do you look back at that? Did you learn anything from seeing those prejudices?
I know where I'm not going on holiday. They call themselves Shia Muslims. And they believe it to the core. They practice it and preach it in everything they say and do. But after reading the Quran, which is probably one of the most peaceful, sensible books I've read in a long time, they sure don't practice what they preach. The stuff that's in that book is nothing to what I saw on the ground. They turned a religious fundamental idea into a political blanket.
So understanding all this, I'd like to move on to a few other questions.
Sure.
But did you see your role as useful then?
Not at all. All I wanted to do was make sure that nobody got too sick, that they got... Well, we had an incident where we had some guys got some chemical burns on them, and that was from some dust mustard. And that's because they broke the rules. They went swimming in a wadi on the side of a road when they shouldn't have been, and it had been tainted with dust mustard. So they got blisters, really bad blisters. We had to fly them back out to Germany. But that was my only concern, is that nobody got hurt. Nobody got killed. No Canadians got killed or hurt. That was my biggest concern.
But overall, you didn't really feel that...
No,
that
we only had one fatality, and that was on the Iraqi side, so I don't think there's a member or civilian in Canada that knows that there is a Canadian fatality in Iraq. Was it useful? Not really. Not internationally, not in the bigger picture. I don't think it was at all, really.
Okay, well, let's talk about then. Going back after your service,
mm-hmm.
how was it like, to leave Iraq and Iran, sorry, and come back to Canada after seeing all that you saw?
Couldn't wait. It was probably one of the more interesting repatriations too. It was a weird mission. We were flown. We had to take an Iranian Hercules aircraft from back to Iran to Tehran, which was a very unsafe aircraft to be in because there were no seats. So we flew in this Hercules to Tehran. We were put up in a 3-star hotel in Tehran for 3 days. I got to see the American Embassy. It's now a propaganda museum. I got to see entire sections of Tehran that have been bombed into parking lots. The Iraqis were actually scudding Tehran quite regularly, and I actually got to see entire sections of the town just wiped out from that. And then there was this 3-star hotel that we lived in, which had all the beautiful meals and everything that was all right. The Sharats were always all over us. That's their secret police, making sure that we didn't leave. And then the Russians flew us out. Was it Mehrabad Airport? The big airport in Tehran. We flew on Aeroflot from Tehran to get this Moscow. Did a refuel layover in Moscow. That's a party town after you've been dry for 3 or 4 months. Actually, it was a very wet flight. We drank them out of all their Heineken on the flight, I think. And then we flew from Moscow to Mirabel. Got in at about 3 o'clock the next morning in Mirabel. The Right Honorable Mr. Beatty, the Minister of National Defense at that point, met us at the airport. These guys went high. He waved us through customs, thank goodness. The guys were bringing back a lot of stuff that shouldn't have been. Stuff that goes boom. Got on a bus, got back to Petawawa. I left that unit as quick as I could. Went back to the airborne lines. They threw my beret out. That was another funny thing, actually. They were so quick to get us over there. I didn't get a blue beret or a ball cap until we were flying to Tehran.
Really?
Yep. That's how fast they got us over there.
Wow.
And I remember that. Just went, don't want that.
Me too.
I couldn't get that freaking thing off my head fast enough.
Do you want to explain what was going through your head when you...
Frickin' UN isn't worth it. The stuff that they go do isn't worth the paper it's written on. I was absolutely disgusted and embarrassed. I felt like a neutered soldier the entire time I was with that organization. Couldn't get out of it quick enough.
Do you want to talk a bit about if you had any emotional hardships seeing the things that you saw?
Mm-hmm. I still have a lot of troubles coming to terms with a couple of things. bartering at POWs, exchanges, I thought was kind of a sick thing to see. Colonel was worth five sergeants. That kind of stuff was going on. And just, you know, body exchanges were pretty gross. Actually, body exchanges were really gross.
Do you want to explain what do you mean by body exchanges?
Body exchanges is that they would exchange bodies across the border. They would repatriate POWs, and they would repatriate war dead, too, if they had some. And the Iranians were just sick, twisted people at that point. You know, if they got a body with no legs on it, they sent one over with no legs on it. That was the kind of stuff that we were dealing with, you know, and it's sick. It was just cruel, sick stuff to see.
Living in Canada where that stuff is unheard of, that must have been hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you feel that the government, you know, gave sufficient services to you and your fellow colleagues when you came back?
Our repatriation services, as far as our medical, consisted of, I had to provide 3 cubes of blood, 1 urine sample, and 3 fecal samples.
That's it?
That's it. That was my repatriation medical.
And no other services?
If you're thinking psychological services, there's no such thing at that time.
So did you talk to other people about, like you said, how when you're over there you didn't talk about how to cope with the things that you saw. Mm-hmm. Did you, once
when
you
we
were
got back?
Yeah.
Not really. Me and Roma were just getting, like, Roma had just gotten posted to the airborne the year before I, or a year after I did, and I actually sponsored his posting when he got there. He's a French-Canadian guy, one of the few I had a lot of time for. Nice guy. So we got along great. Like, he was my fine UN friend, as we always used to joke about. We got back. There was stuff that we just wouldn't talk. It was almost, we were embarrassed to talk about stuff. Because you felt emaciated, you felt neutered. You're supposed to be going over there to help people, and they take all those tools away from you, and just, we weren't peacekeepers, we were freaking war watchers. You know?
So you just witnessed what was
going
on. That
was it. That we were just freaking war watchers. You know, and I got back, I did my medical. My contract was coming up for renewal. I told my boss, you know, I really don't think I need to renew this right now. I think I might just take some time. And boom, we were on Christmas leave. We came back from Christmas leave, right into an exercise workup for exercise up in Alaska. And my boss asked me again, Dave, are you sure? Since we were having a party just before all the guys, he was going up with all the guys up to Edmonton and then flying up to Wainwright, Alaska. You sure you don't want to go? No, I'm going to cut my losses here and take time off. I'll take a year off at least. Oh, okay. And that was on a Friday. No, that was on a Tuesday. On a Thursday, we lost 5 guys from 2 Commando. There was a car accident. The guys were partying up, getting ready to go. So they had 5 guys got killed in a car accident.
In Canada?
Yeah. And then that Sunday, the boss I was talking to or whatnot, his Hercules crashed in Fort Wainwright, Alaska, and we lost 9 guys from there.
Wow.
So I thought, no, it's icing on the cake. There's the cherry. I'm gonna take my time off. So I got out, came back to Saskatoon, drank and fished for a year, and then got right back on the horse.
Thank you for sharing some of these personal experiences. I know it might be difficult to talk about, so I thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that your worldview changed then?
I wasn't nearly as naive as I was before I went, I'll tell you that. There's the old saying, it's true, you don't believe none of what you hear and half of what you see. And I found that out firsthand. You know, the media is going to show you what they want to show you, and they're going to tell you what they want you to think, is basically what it comes down to. And I found out what you hear and see may be totally different from what you experience on the ground. So yeah, I became a little bit more embittered, jaded, whatever you want to call it, frustrated, almost bordering apathetic.
So you remember this service not very fondly then, or?
Not really.
Were there any positive
outcome of that?
Yeah.
I got to see some really neat ancient stuff in some Persian historical stuff, which was kind of neat. Got to spit in the Tigris and Euphrates River. Wow. The desert, it's a beautiful place to see. It's absolutely gorgeous.
In Iran.
I saw mountain ranges that look like those little glass sand things with all the different colors of sand. I've seen mountain ranges that look like that with turquoise stones and red stones and wadis carved from water that's been gone for 10,000 years. Beautiful, beautiful country. Absolutely gorgeous. Just don't smell it. There are a lot of red-headed kids in the Middle East, believe it or not. I don't know why. They dye their head red on the kids, a lot of them. Which is a striking color to see with kids.
Is there anything you'd like to conclude with saying about your mission?
I don't know. When I hear about people talking about peacekeeping and peacekeeping missions and peacekeeping support missions, especially when they're non-military, I go on the defensive right away. I get a little angst. You know, because Canada is so quick to throw people at the very first inkling that there might be a peace mission in the world. They just want to cast Canadian soldiers at it, and that's what they did to us. They cast us at this mission without any background, without any thought, without any idea of what was actually going on the ground, let alone what stones were they throwing. You know, what troops are you throwing at that? You know, so I get a little frustrated when I hear, oh yeah, let's send some peacekeepers over there. I just want to grab by the throat. Spell peacekeeper first before you send one. If anything else came out of this, and I know it would have all been backdoor, in Kingston, at CFB Kingston in Ontario right now, they have a peace support training cell there that you have to go to before you are sent on any peacekeeping mission in the world. If Unimog, if Vagabond had anything to do with that, no, I'm happy. I wouldn't do that to anybody else, so I wouldn't send nobody else there like that. That's just not fair. But it happened.
Okay, well, thank you very much for sharing your memories and your experience on for this interview. I'd like to say on behalf of Canadians that we did appreciate your service. And I'd just like to say, again, thank you. So,
you're welcome.
All right.